Yeah, we're in good shape,
All right.
looks like. All right. Okay, this is Michael O'Rourke for the Washington County Historical Society, beginning an interview today with Jose Jaime. I guess I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah.
And the date is the
11th of February.
Of February, right.
2001.
Exactly. So, Jose, I wonder if we could start at the beginning. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Mexico, about 60 miles south of Mexico City, in a town near Cuernavaca. If I say the name of the town, probably nobody will know about it, but I'll say it anyway, Mazatepec, in the state of Morelos. Probably the better known city of the state is Cuernavaca. Mm-hmm. And Cuernavaca is about 40 miles south, so I am still further south, 20 more miles.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And that was a while back, so.
1942. And can you tell me a little bit about your family? What were your parents doing at that time?
My family is a farming family. We had our land, and we cultivated the land in Mexico, and it was really a lot of hard work, and I will not say that we were really poor, but we were surviving. The crops have never been that good in land that is supposed to be giving us the crops only through the natural rain. And sometimes the rain was good, sometimes the rain was not. So it was up and down. And we were 10 children. I was the 10th of 10. So I probably got the benefit of being the baby. And I did not work as hard in the fields as my older brothers and sisters. But a couple of them didn't see that our family was really that well off, and decided to come up to the States as braceros. Mm-hmm. And in the late 40s. And it was an experience that I still remember. We were always waiting for their letters. Mm-hmm. And even for their checks, because a lot of times we depended on their checks to buy the seed, to buy everything that we needed to cultivate the land. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and I was just a kid at that time.
And so these were two of your older siblings?
Siblings, yes. Mm-hmm.
And what were their names?
One of them is Tito Jaime. He's still up in the States. He decided to stay up here. He lives in California. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Wenceslao. And he is deceased. He developed stomach cancer. Uh-huh. And passed away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And can you tell me a little bit about your mother and father? What were they like as persons?
I could say that I was very attached to them, because they were very loving, in as much as they had to distribute their love to 10 of us. Since I was the baby, I probably got the best of not only my parents, but also of all my siblings. And they were very humble, very uneducated. They only went to, my mother went to 1 year of grade school. Mm-hmm. My dad went, I think, to 2 years of grade school. And they had to leave school at that time because of the persecution and all the problems that were happening at the time. So they only knew how to work and work hard in order to survive. And that's how my brothers and sisters were raised, mm-hmm. who you need to work and work hard. In fact, my oldest brother, who is down in California, I think he only went to 3 years of grade school.
Mm-hmm. And just for the record, what were your parents' names?
My dad is Vincent, or Vicente Jaime, and my mom is Petra Toledo.
And are they still living?
Both of them passed away. My dad passed away in 79 at the ripe age of 77 years of age. And my mother passed away in 1993, mm-hmm. at the ripe age of 93. Uh-huh. So we were counting just how many children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren my mother knew at the time of her passing away. And we counted 210.
Wow.
All together.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned persecution as a problem that they experienced. Now, can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, in those days, the Campesino movement, under the leadership of Zapata, Emiliano Zapata, they were trying to fight for, the goal they had was that the land should belong to those who cultivate it. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were a lot of haciendas, owners of large amounts of land, and they would have all the people to work for them, just basically like slaves. So they revolted against that, and they joined forces, and in fact, they had a big army, probably not properly armed, but they did have an army under the leadership of Zapata. In fact, my mother's dad, my grandfather, Gabriel Toledo, was one of Zapata's generals.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So, your mother's family, anyway. It sounds like right. You were quite involved with Zapata then.
Yes, mm-hmm, very much so.
Mm-hmm. And your mm-hmm. your father as well then, or?
They did not get as much when they were married. It was more. It was more like they were probably young at that age, maybe teenagers, and so they didn't get involved as much. Their involvement was more into rearing a family and just be a family.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And were your parents religious people?
Very, very religious, like the majority of our families in smaller towns. They concentrate a lot on the fact that if they don't have anything else, they will have a very strong attachment to their faith and to religion and to the family as such. I think they were part of the rest of the families that were ignorant, very uneducated, but very religious. Uh-huh. And I would say that they were also very hardworking uh-huh. Families.
And so they were active in a church then at where you lived?
They might not have known a true definition of their faith, but they actually could die for their faith in the same manner that a lot of the Cristeros in the Cristero movement, they would be saying, long live Our Lady of Guadalupe and long live Christ the King, and start, you know, fighting for their lives and willing to give their lives for the movement. So even if they didn't know that well what their faith was, mm-hmm. at least they couldn't define it. But definitely they were committed to it.
Mm-hmm. And so you were brought up in that kind of
spirit, mm-hmm. Attached to the family, attached to religion, attached to looking after each other. Government programs were non-existent. Mm-hmm. So we needed to survive, and the only way we could survive is by helping each other, not only as family, but families to families. And that was the way to do it. Uh-huh. I should also say that because of my parents' lack of education, when I was a kid, I was seeing how hard they were working, my brothers and my dad. And I asked my dad one time, I don't want to be a farmer like you. How can I do something else besides farming? He says, the only thing that you can do is educate yourself. And I wanted to be a medical doctor. And he says, well, you know that we don't have the means to send you to the university. So one time there was a priest that came by and said, they gave us a talk in our grade school. He gave us a talk in our grade school. And they said, who wants to go to the seminary to study? And I was like 10 or 11. I didn't know what seminary was, but I understood to study. Uh-huh. So I raised my hand, and that's how I landed in the seminary. Uh-huh. At the age of 12, for when I finished grade school, I went to the seminary at the age of 12 high school.
Okay, and this is a seminary in
the seminary.
Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Cuernavaca.
At Cuernavaca, okay. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And that's how I started. I went to the seminary for high school in Cuernavaca, and then they sent me to New Mexico to a Mexican seminary for college. Mm-hmm. We called it philosophy. And then on my fourth year of college, I was transferred from the seminary in New Mexico to Mount Angel Seminary.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It coincided with Castro getting rid of the Catholic Church in Cuba and as much as he could. So a lot of the seminarians needed a place to stay. The seminary in New Mexico said, we can offer more spaces, but we need some of the present seminarians to go to another place. So that's how I got sent up here.
Uh-huh. Okay, from mm-hmm. New Mexico.
From New Mexico.
Because of the overflow from Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just one other, essentially it sounds like your mother, at least, if you consider, with supporting Zapata, a political act. It sounds like she was somewhat politically involved then.
Very, very. In as much as she could be involved, being a female, it was more like in the back, uh-huh. not in front. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so, would you say that both your parents were somewhat political people too, or?
In as much as you can be politically involved in a community where the priorities are basic survival.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So belonging to a movement or something like that, you know, not having the education to read about it, you know, they were not that politically involved. They could easily be motivated to do something, which they did, but on a permanent basis to be members of a political party or anything like that, no. They had other more important business to deal with, like bringing food to the table.
Uh-huh. Did they talk to their children about the way the world works, though, and things like this, or did you get much of that from your parents?
Not much. You had to remember that in a small town, people didn't probably know beyond their town.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have the means to go out, for example, to the big city of Cuernavaca or to the big metropolis of Mexico City. It was a luxury
mm-hmm.
that they couldn't afford.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned how you got into the seminary. How was school for you? Sounds like you were very interested in studying in school.
Ever since then, because I did not want to work in agriculture. I did not want to sweat and toil and just barely survive from all that sweat and toil. I wanted to continue on my education one way or another, and if I couldn't get it from my parents, I could get it from scholarships or the like.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, I went through my career. I got my bachelor's at the seminary, and then I also got my Master of Divinity from the seminary, and then I got my Master of Arts from the seminary. And just recently, in 97, I graduated from PSU with a Master's in Social Work, subsidized by OHSU at the place where I was working. So
uh-huh.
I have always believed that education is the way to go if you want to get ahead of the game.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And has it been easy for you to be a student?
It has, because I have always liked to study. I have always liked books. I have always been enjoying reading, and I always try to update myself. In 86, when I got married and we started having children, one of the children that we had was a computer. So I figured my children can grow up with the computer, since it's the computer age. Uh-huh. So now that they are growing up also with the same type of, not as much intensity and commitment to education, because they probably have it better off than I had it when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
So they cannot comprehend that yet, but hopefully they will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the motivation is not as strong.
Not as strong, yeah.
And then, so you came up here in 63, was it?
In 61.
61.
Yeah.
Okay.
In 63, I first came to Washington County to work with the Valley Migrant League.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in 61, you came to Mount Angel?
To Mount Angel to graduate from college.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Then I went back to Mexico. Part of the process in the seminary was that after we finished college, we were teachers to the high school seminary for a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there for 2 years, and I was teaching English, and I was also working for the diocesan newspaper. Mm-hmm. As the co-editor of the paper at that time.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you went back to Mexico and then came up here in 63.
And then I came back for postgraduate studies to study philosophy.
Okay.
To study theology after my philosophy years, to study theology. In 65, in 63 I came here to work for and help with the Valley Migrant League. But in 65, 61, 63, I was here. In 65 is when I first came here to Hillsborough to help out with the Valley Migrant League. I was misplacing the years. It's 65.
Oh, it's 65.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's going back too long ago. But 65, 67, I came here to continue my studies in theology.
Okay, and you came to continue studies in theology.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then
the summer I would work in different places.
Uh-huh.
Just to because we couldn't afford I couldn't afford to go back to Mexico during the summer, so I had to stay here and work in different places that I was able to locate.
Uh-huh.
And then in 67 I went back to Mexico because I wanted to join, instead of being in the seminary, I wanted to join the newly founded Benedictine Priory that Mount Angel was establishing in Cuernavaca.
Uh-huh.
So I joined the Benedictines in 67.
Okay. During that 65 to 67 period when you were working with the Valley Migrant League,
mm-hmm.
can you tell me a little bit about that, what your work was and what the organization was like?
The Valley Migrant League was not really having the Hispanic community was not really accepting of the programs that the Valley Migrant League was offering to them. There was another lady that used to be the head of the Valley Migrant League and was aware that they were not giving to the Hispanic community what the Hispanic community needed. So she decided to leave that agency and start forming another one with the Hispanic community. And it was called VIVA,
uh-huh.
which was Volunteers in Vanguard Action. Her name was Ruby Illy. And I don't know where she is, I don't know if she's still alive or what, but anyway, she had quite a follow-up with the Hispanic community, and they were more of more politically how can I put it, more politically with more political teeth, you know, trying to fight for a cause. Whereas the Valley Migrant League was more or less complacent with having the funding from the federal government to do programs.
So the Viva was a more activist.
Yes, more of an activist agency than the Valley Migrant League. But the person that stayed with the Valley Migrant League was a young man that was full of idealism. He came to the seminary to talk to two of us to see if we were interested in coming to rescue the Valley Migrant League. One of them was Joe Garcia from California, and me from Mexico. And we talked about it, and Joe and I decided that we wanted to see if we could rescue the Valley Migrant League at that time. So he was the he got the job of the director of the Valley Migrant League in Hillsborough, and I was like program aide.
Okay, and who is the person that came to you?
His name is John Hughes. Okay. John Hughes.
And his position at that time?
He was like, I don't know if he was assistant to Ruby Ely, okay, assistant to the director, or what kind of a position he had. But he is the one that asked us to see if we could come and rescue the agency. And we did.
And Ruby Ely at that time was
there were two agencies fighting against each other.
Okay,
one with money and funding for programs, and the other one more with the commitment of the Hispanic community.
So that would be the Viva organization.
Yeah, Viva organization. Right. So John Hughes, now his brother is the mayor of Hillsborough.
Okay.
Tom Hughes.
Okay. But Ruby Ely then supported this idea of reinvigorating the Valley Migrant League. Is that
no? She left. She left the Valley Migrant League because she was not happy with how things were coming along. Because she was so activist, they didn't want people like that in a federally funded agency.
And Ruby Ely was not Hispanic, or
no, but she knew Spanish.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. She was quite bilingual, and I would even say quite bicultural.
So she had some real contact with the community. Mm-hmm. Then
very much. Mm-hmm. Very much so. Mm-hmm. Whereas John Hughes was not bilingual, was not bicultural. And that's why he wanted to get the two of us here to help out.
Mm-hmm. And when you say to rescue the Valley Migrant League, was it in actual trouble at that point then, or was it just the lack of support from the Hispanic
community? It was the lack of support from the Hispanic community.
Okay.
Basically, and they had those agencies were really funded with a lot of money, and people were not seeing results, good results for the Hispanic community. So in a way, it was kind of tricky for us, because we needed to convince the Hispanic community that that the agency did have some programs that were worth their while. And it was going to be only temporarily for 3 months during the summer, because we needed to go back to the seminary in September. So we decided to give it a try.
And how did it work then?
I think it worked fine. It was at that time when one of the projects that we had was to invoke the ability of churches to help out. And at that time, one of the principles we had was if these migrant families are going to be getting out of poverty, they need to be out of their cycle of migrancy. So our emphasis was in establishing ways so that families could settle in Washington County. So we had like about 12 or 14 churches that were able to say for kind of adopting a family for 6 months. They would provide housing and employment for 6 months so that the family did not have to worry about anything but to look for a good gainful employment and house. And most of them ended up getting jobs with Tektronix, which was in those years just beginning.
Right.
And
in fact, I worked out at Tech in those years.
And they all were able to find a house and buy it because they were able to save 6 months of rent, and they could buy their homes. So at least 12 to 14 families were able to benefit from that program, and they settled down, and they were really the ones that became the core of the Hispanic community to start a lot of other programs, like Centro Cultural, the Virginia Garcia Clinic, and the like.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me maybe in general what the situation of the Hispanic community was in those days compared to now? I mean, it sounds like
it was the Hispanic community definitely was much, much smaller. The Hispanic community only increased in big numbers during the summer for the crops, to pick up the crops.
And this is the migrancy problem
right,
that you were talking about earlier.
Right. Definitely at that time you wouldn't see all the many signs in Spanish in the different stores and the different malls like you see nowadays. Mm-hmm. At that time we were probably thinking that the Hispanic community increased in the state of Oregon to about 70,000-80,000 a year during the summer months. When I came back years later, like in 1979, the number had increased more, but it was more single men than families. Uh-huh. In those years, it was mostly families in the cycle of migrancy. Mm-hmm. So the camps, in the migrant camps, were really something. Well, I should say, like slave camps. Uh-huh. Because it was probably, I wouldn't say that this room was much bigger or much smaller, maybe about this size, in which they would fit a family of 6, 8, 10 people. Uh-huh. With just two large bunk beds, and everything was in here, the kitchen, and they would go outside for their toiletry needs. Mm-hmm. So it got only worse because with the years, those cabins, as they were called, those cabins became deteriorated. Uh-huh. And the farmers never really took living conditions seriously. They, I mean, there were about 30 plus migrant camps. And we could never say we recommend this camp with good living conditions for the families.
Because there weren't any that to be recommended.
No.
Uh-huh. And that's changed now, I assume.
Well, the camps are older, the cabins are deteriorated, so they are worse. And that's why families don't even come.
Ah. So oh, you mean now the camps aren't much better?
Yeah, they are worse.
Okay.
They are much worse.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, there might be a one or two camps that could probably say, well, this has improved a lot. Mm-hmm. But there are not too many.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's still a problem then.
It is. It is still a problem. Mm-hmm. There has been housing developed for migrant families now in the different towns in Hillsboro, in Forest Grove, and it's pretty much improved. I mean, it's like it looks like a set of a complex of apartments.
Uh-huh.
So
there's an alternative.
Yeah,
anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there has been an alternative, But the camps themselves are not have not been improved.
Uh-huh. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when you so you took that assignment on then for the summer to work on rehabilitating the Valley Migrant League, and you mentioned the program that mm-hmm. established the 12 or 14 families.
One of the projects that we had, since we knew that we were going to be there temporarily, was to look from people of the community that could take over the Valley Migrant League. And it was then at that time that we got from the migrant families an individual that became the director of the Valley Migrant League in Hillsborough. And his name is Sonny Montes. And you're going to be hearing that name, or you should be hearing that name quite often.
Uh-huh.
So that was our legacy, to get some individuals from the migrant families themselves uh-huh. to take over the Valley Migrant League.
And so you identified Montes then during this three-month mm-hmm. period also?
Yeah, it was Sonny Montes and John Little. Mm-hmm. Actually, John Little was the director. Sonny Montes was the director later on.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But we got him to work for us as a program aide.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And would you say that, what happened to the Valley Migrant League then after that? Did they gain some
a happy
support?
Death. The Valley Migrant League died a happy death, you know, when the funding doesn't arrive anymore, that's it. They
yeah.
just disband.
Right, but in the interval when it still enjoyed some funding, sounds like they were in better contact with the community than previously. It's a couple of sentences. So you thought it was improved.
It was a quick stunt, but after we left, I think it was improved. Mm-hmm. And we came back and forth during the school year to see how things were coming along, just to visit and stay together with them. There was not as much of a problem for them to continue with their programs as there had been before.
Uh-huh. Okay. And mm-hmm. in the meantime, Viva was still side by side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And did it remain the more activist organization?
It remained the more activist. Mm-hmm. But of course, after I don't know how long Ruby was staying here. Not much afterwards. I think she only stayed here for maybe a year or two, and then after she was gone, Viva went down.
Ah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. And the year again, the summer, was that the summer of 65?
The summer of, I came back in 65, summer of 66.
Summer of 66, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went back to the seminary in Mexico, is that right?
At the end of the school year of 66, 67.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then what came next for you?
Well, I was there in Mexico, 66, 67. I went to Mexico City to continue my theology studies in 68. And then in 69, I came back here to finish my theology studies. In 70, I went back to Mexico, and after I had completed my theology studies, I went back to Mexico to the Benedictine monastery, and I was just being a member of the community, planting a lot of avocado trees, because we decided to, since the Benedictines have the tradition of trying to support themselves without having to live from the handouts from people, we started cultivating the land. So I went back to to cultivating the land myself. We were growing corn, but we decided to start planting avocado trees because we thought that on the long range planning, and that would be less work and probably more income.
Mm-hmm.
So we planted close to maybe 2,000 trees,
uh-huh.
And hopefully they are still remembering me that I planted them.
So your education brought you back to agricultural work.
Back to agricultural work, which I didn't mind because I did not have to really sweat and toil that the same as my parents did and my brothers. Yeah. So we were only working a few hours and then go back to church and pray. And so it was not too bad. And I stayed there until my ordination as a priest in 71. Mm-hmm. And I was working in the seminary, in the monastery, and we were in charge of the minor seminary of the diocese. So I was still teaching and helping out with different things until I was sent to Panama to the International Cooperatives Institute to study cooperativism, because we wanted to help the community where the monastery was established. We wanted to make sure that we could be part of their organizing, so that they could see other ways to bring revenues to their to their families' needs. And we thought that co-ops was the way to do it. And in a way, we were even subsidizing some of those co-ops. We had a rabbit co-op, a pig co-op, and a chicken co-op. Mm-hmm. And we involved like about, possibly about 30 families in each co-op, so that they would use the animals to increase their income and the revenues as families. And in as much as we were helping out the co-ops, the families were doing okay. As soon as we were not helping out, then the co-ops went down the drain.
So
I don't think we stayed long enough to make sure that the co-ops run by themselves. And the principle of a co-op is that it has to be the co-op members that need to make it survive, otherwise it will not survive. And that's what happened. Once I left, once the other individuals that were helping with the co-ops left, the spirit was not there.
And did you have any sense that that might be the outcome based on your knowledge of the people you're working with?
Because that's why I went to Panama to study, and I knew if the people were not going to be taking ownership, they were not going to be successful.
Yeah. And what would you say was the problem there? Was it just that it sounds like you have defined the problem. They didn't take ownership. They were relying too much on you.
I think it was like Big Daddy telling them this is what you need. And them saying, I don't think that's what we need. I think it's the same problem that we had with the Valley Migrant League. The Fed saying, this is what you need, and this is the money that we're giving you for your programs. And except, the people didn't take ownership.
Except in this case, it sounds like at least Big Daddy was a little bit closer to the roots of the problem than the federal government.
So, but it was an interesting process. It's my whole life has been a constant process of education, and the community, especially the community of the poor, it's so difficult to be part and parcel with them if you are not with them. The poor know who is with them and who is not. And I think no matter where the poor live, that's the case. So in order to convince the poor to help themselves, they know how to do it. People coming from the outside are probably not the best to be part and parcel with them.
And when you say they know whether you're with them, do you mean like literally with them in terms of your own economic circumstances, et cetera? So you have to be one of them, is that what you're saying?
Basically. Uh-huh. Basically. That's what happened to Zapata. He was successful because he was one of them. Mm-hmm. And they knew he was one of them. Mm-hmm. He was one of the peons working hard in one of the haciendas.
Uh-huh. And so if you're outside the poor community, no matter how much
your
you educate yourself and no matter how much you try to identify with their situation, you won't gain acceptance?
You're still a foreigner to them.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, that was quite an experience. And so when I came back in 77, I came back here because the superior of the monastery was not very happy that I was too involved with the people in the parish and organizing them in co-ops, and he wanted me to be more of a hermit and just be in prayers and in the chapel. So he says, why don't you just go back to Mount Angel and learn some more from our mother abbey. So I came back, and that's when I started working for my master's degree in Master of Divinity and Master of Arts. In 77 and 78, I got my 2 degrees, and that's when I took the opportunity to get back into the Hispanic community involvement here. The local priest, Father Frank Canuso, I think he should be interviewed by the historical societies, because he did a lot of work for the Hispanic community. He was going through a process of maybe feeling burnt out, so he needed to he needed some help. So he asked me if I could help. It coincided with the fact that Centro Cultural had been established. I think Centro Cultural was established in 71 or 72. And had gone through different projects. The Hispanic community were really part of it, and that's why it lasted so long. And they were trying to get funding, but not from the feds, more from their own. So they were selling enchiladas, and they were selling Mexican meals to raise funds to buy a house in Cornelius. And the church, the Catholic Church in Cornelius, was always part and parcel of Centro Cultural. So Father Arnie Beezer is the one that founded Centro Cultural with the Hispanic community. The 12, 14 families that I told you that were settled during the years of the Valley Migrant League, they were the core group that founded Centro Cultural. They had been working together in 77 when I was visiting Centro Cultural and the programs. I got into a good relationship. In 78, they had some serious problems. So they asked me if I would want to come back and work for them and with them. So I said, well, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see what happens. So I went in 77, I went back to Mexico. I stayed 76, 77, getting my degrees. In 77, I left and came back in 78. And I said, because they want to see me, they really wanted me to come back and work for them in Hillsborough. So I said, okay, I'll see if I can get permission from my superiors, and I'll go. So I came back, and I was working with Father Frank, taking care of the mission church here in Cornelius. And I was working full time. The only way that I could come is by being subsidized, not by the diocese, because they didn't have any funding or whatever, but I looked for funding for myself. So I got a job with the local Washington County Community Action. And they put me to work for the programs for the Hispanic community. And one of the programs was to resurrect Centro Cultural because it had been disbanded.
Aha, uh-huh. Okay.
So from 78 to 80, we started reformatting the board of directors of Centro Cultural. We started analyzing the bylaws and getting young blood on the board of directors. And my philosophy has always been that if this was an agency of the community, it had to be run by the community. So I gave myself a couple of years to see if I could achieve that. And so the first thing that I did was to get young people as board members. In fact, that one of those young people that was a member of the board is Enedelia Hernandez, who is now the principal of Echo Show in Cornelius. Another one was Margaret Garza, who was the director of the Fairplex. Yes. Here in Hillsborough. I mean, those people that were involved became real leaders in not only the Hispanic community, but the community at large. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I feel good about it. At that time, the city of Cornelius had requested funding to build the community center in Cornelius. And they got the money from the block grant. When they found out that the money did not come with administration monies, they said, we don't want it. I was the director of Centro Cultural at that time, and I said, well, the money has been approved. We want it. We want to build the community center, and we will administer it. We'll worry about administration expenses. So there was, it was a political battle that polarized Cornelius.
Uh-huh. I'll bet.
So we didn't have a staff at Centro Cultural. We only had volunteers because Centro Cultural had always been running with volunteers, either through Vista volunteers or Jesuit volunteers or volunteers from the community. So, but we had the power. We had all the people interested in helping out. So we started canvassing Cornelius house to house and convincing them that the money had been approved to build the community center, that we could do it. We even offered a collateral, the old building that we had where Centro Cultural was, as a collateral that we were responsible. Anyway, we finally got the money through a lot of sweat and toil. This was real sweat and toil, not the migrant sweat and toil that my parents had, but a different kind of sweat and toil. But we finally got the money. We got the funding. I was a member of the public advisory board for the block grant. So I started talking to each one of the individuals in the public advisory board, saying, "Hey, this is a good thing for the community at large, and we can run it." So all the political involvement, all the political savvy that I was able to grasp from any place, I was able to use it, and we finally got the money. I also wanted to make sure that Centro Cultural did not have a lack of funding, at least for the director and a couple of other staff people. Mm-hmm. And I went to United Way, and I said, "This is an agency that merits membership of in the United Way." And through a lot of political maneuverings and through a lot of involvement from the community, they finally accepted and they got Centro Cultural as a member. So we secured at least 25% of revenues for Centro Cultural, at least to pay the executive director and at least one or two other people on the staff. Uh-huh. So I said, okay, now we are ready to put somebody as executive director of this agency. And we posted the position and we got Enrique Medina to come and be the director. Enrique Medina was a classmate of mine in the seminary.
But you were the acting director until that time then?
I was the director, yeah, because I wanted to go back to Mexico.
Okay, so you weren't interested in becoming the permanent executive
director? I was never interested in being a permanent. I always think that if an agency is going to survive, it's the people that form the agency that need to take ownership.
Mm-hmm. But of course you were sort of involved in forming this agency.
So when he became the director, he got all the funding to build the community center. What originally was going to be a 500,000 community center, because of all the time that it took for finally getting us getting the money and start building, and all the problems in the construction project, it became, an $800,000 building, which was fine. I mean, we could live with that. Mm-hmm. And once it was built, I came to the inauguration of the building, and it was beautiful to see, you know, that the families had gotten together. The Hispanic community was feeling really good and proud of their center, although it was a community center, but it was the community center of Cornelius, run by Centro Cultural, administered by Centro Cultural. So it went fine until 84. And they were having again some more problems. Basically, they had been using some of the funding for some of the projects to, they were going through what the poor go through. They borrow from Peter to pay Paul. They were using funding from some programs to pay the utilities. And then all of a sudden, this program that provided X number of dollars, the money was not there anymore. And so the board of directors decided to let the executive director go. So they were without a director and without a way to pay for the director. Although they had the funding from United Way, it was in jeopardy. So they went back to Mexico. I said, Jose Jaime, can you come to help us out again?
And so you were in Mexico for this, for the interim period?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I said, I'll give it a try, but only for a year. So they said, if nothing else, just to rescue us for a year. So I came back in 84, about May of 84. And started reorganizing the Hispanic community, all the main leaders, and started working together again. And I think we made a big point of making the agency be of credit to the community at large. My issue was, in a year, I need to get one of the children of the founding families be the executive director of Centro Cultural, because I knew that that was very important. And we had many candidates that applied for the position. In 65, we had two final candidates.
85, you mean?
In 85.
Yeah.
We had two final candidates for the position, and the two of them were members of the founding fathers' children. Mm-hmm. One of them was Arturo Cortez, and the other one was Ruma Perez. So the board decided to hire Ruma Perez, and he was the director till from 85 through 92, I think. I left in 91. He stayed another year or two, 92 or 93. Mm-hmm. And he was there as the director, and in 85 I went back to Mexico again. In September of 85 we had the huge earthquake in Mexico City, and I was down there, I was mopping the floor because I was staying with my mom and working in a parish nearby. And it was a lot of devastation. Luckily, my hometown was not did not suffer any damages. But I went back to Mexico because I was ambivalent as to continue working as a priest or leave the ministry. And I wanted to be near my bishop so that I could consult with him and have him as my counselor and advisor. So around November, I made the decision that I was going to leave the ministry. So in December, I came back here to Oregon, and I ended up looking for employment here in Oregon. And there was a position for a program that I had written the grant for, the Education Department of Centro Cultural. So I applied for that position. The person that I hired as the executive director hired me. And I thought it was wise, because then I could continue helping him. I could be a mentor to him without necessarily being on the spotlight, and help him out from the sidelines. So we started working on other programs, like when I was with the Community Action Agency, we founded the Translators Bureau, which was transferred from Community Action to Centro Cultural because it was a source of revenue, a source of income for Centro Cultural. And so I was the director of the Translators Bureau and of the Education Department. Mm. And I stayed there until 80. I was hired in February of 86. And then I married in May of 86. I worked for Centro Cultural until 91. And then I got a job. I had come to the point of saying, if I work for a nonprofit agency, I will end up with nonprofit, which is the plight of the poor. And being already of age, having family, three young kids, trying to work for nonprofit was really bugging me. And my interest was, I want the families to take ownership of Centro Cultural. They have already taken ownership. It's time for me to go and let them be on their own. So I applied to different agencies, and the first one that called me if I wanted to work for them was the probation office here in Washington County. Mm-hmm. I was here for a couple of months. In the meantime, another state agency asked me if I wanted to work for them, they would increase my salary. And I went for a few more months, and OHSU came and said, we pay you better, come to work for us. So I ended up in OHSU from 92 through 99. Mm-hmm. And then I applied for the job here as the one of the supervisors of the Community Correction Center. Mm-hmm. And I was hired. So I've been here since September of 99.
Okay. And let's back up a little bit on these jobs. So you worked for a while as probation, in the probation office. Uh-huh. Here in Washington County government. What was your specific
probation
duties?
Officer.
Okay, so mm-hmm. you talked to people, uh-huh. monitored people while they were on probation?
Yeah, it was basically with the not too high of a risk offenders.
Uh-huh.
And it was a group, three of us that were in charge of all those individuals that just needed to come and report and pay their $25 or $30 a month and tell them, go see no more. Uh-huh. Come back next month and pay us. The uh-huh. same thing. As long as they were compliant, that's what we were doing. And if we could also have recommended bench probation for some of them, if they were not really doing anything bad. So it was only 2 months, so I could not say that I did master the job of a probation officer.
Were you working mostly with Hispanic clients then, or
no?
Okay.
All the non-risky clients.
Okay. And then
I was social service specialist for CSD for a few more months. Also, I did not really grasp the job that I needed to do there. Usually they put you in through a lot of training, and that was it. And then I was transferred. I accepted the position with OHSU.
And what was that?
OHSU
position?
Was very interesting because it was really more of a fulfillment of what I thought I was fulfilling a mission. I was helping families look for funding for their medical expenses. So I was a social service specialist in the financial aspect. Mm-hmm. So I was, our goal was to help the families bring in revenues to OHSU. So we were helping the families and bringing in revenues to the agency. And our group, we were only three of them when I got there. And when I left, we were 14. Our group was the only one that increased in number because of the money that we were bringing in. And we never suffered any cuts, like some other departments were being cut 10% or 6% or 11%, depending on which departments they were. Our department was increasing on a year-to-year basis, especially when the Oregon Health Plan came on board. And we only had a window of time to make sure that that the people that were eligible for those, for that particular program, to be enrolled so that they could pay their bills. So our group started making around $7 to $8 million a year when we were only three. By the time I left in 99, our group was making like $3-4 million a week.
this is when you say making, this is
bringing revenues,
in money that
from the different programs
on behalf of your clients then.
Mm-hmm. And I was dealing with all kinds of clients, not only Hispanics.
How did you raise the money?
Basically, helping them get into all the different programs available to them.
Okay.
The Oregon Health Plan, Social Security Disability, Social Security, Aging Services, CSD, you name it, wherever they could get funding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there an example case that you remember that might demonstrate sort of the kinds of creative thinking or whatever you had to do on the job in terms of matching people up with money?
Well, I'm remembering, for example, the case of a little girl that her dad was making like about $100 more, so she wouldn't qualify for funding.
Hold on for 1 second, we're about to...